1989, Scott Hartwick at the Gettysburg Civil War Roundtable.
There is much there, here, and there are some of the I'm Pat Brown, your president. I haven't seen you for a while. I came to Florida last month, and it was cold this morning. In fact, I think now I'm going to stay in Florida from Northern Pennsylvania. That was a good chance to meet the Major General that we were going to meet with inside the division. And they want to talk about the change for it.
Be back.
Thanks for inviting me back. I was here last year. I love my first round. My son tonight was saying, "Dad, are you going to be home tonight?" I said, "I am." He said, "No, I mean, when we go and speak, you can be home." I said, "No, driving to town, 5 minutes away, right back." He's used to some of these round tables where I take off and I'm back from the interview. So it's really nice to drive 5 minutes. Speak to a lot of people that I know. So I like it and I like coming to this round table. Thanks very much for inviting me. The story that we're going to hear tonight still amazes me. I read over what I've written. The program that I'll do tonight is based upon a paper that I did for a seminar that we had a year ago on the non-union of Virginia in the Gettysburg campaign. And I wrote about Pender's Light Division on the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, everybody knows about Pickett's Charge, and everybody has an opinion about Pickett's Charge. And most people walk out and look at the good of Pickett's Charge and say that was madness. No one ever would have done that. What was the mean thing? Well, we're going to find out tonight some of the big men in the world. And we're going to find out how it worked, why it worked, and why we wanted to do it. This is the attack of Dorsey Pender's division against Seminary Ridge. Most of the ground where the heaviest fighting took place in this attack is zoned by the Lutheran Seminary, the YWCA, Green File, the Chrysler Motors. So most of it, this fighting takes place, it's not actually in part done, as you're going to see from some of the slides that we showed you tonight. Lee called upon Pender's division because Henry Heath's division on the first day had driven the First Corps back from McPherson's Ridge. And they had retreated, the First Corps that is, from McPherson's Ridge, west of town, to Seminary Ridge. One of the advantages of the position of the First Corps had on July 1st was a succession of ridges that they could use to form defensive lines. And they were pretty tough to take those positions and cross the Confederates quite a bit. East Division lost nearly 2,000 men on July 1st. By the time they had pushed Federals off McPherson's Ridge, they were exhausted, so it was time to relieve them and send some else in. And the people who got selected to do that was Pender's division. The charge that they're going to make upon Seminary Ridge, I think, in many ways, is symbolic of two things. Symbolic of why Lee's army was so successful up to this point, and why they would be successful even after this point. And it's also symbolic of why they lost the battle of Gettysburg. Our story, we need to understand who these people are. Who are the men of Pender's division? They're not just some big organization of people. Let's meet some of these people. What is this organization called the Light Division? The Light Division was actually created after the Battle of Seven Pines, which took place May 31st, June 1st, 1862. And after that battle, the commander of this new division, his name was Ambrose Powell Hill, consisting of six brigades, was Dick Division. He nicknamed it the Light Division, apparently because they were supposed to make light, quick, rapid maneuvers, which they did. And on more than one battlefield, the light division is predicted to mean that there's a difference in victory and defeat. And the most notable example of this that most people are very well aware of is the Battle of Sharpsburg, when the light division made a 17-mile forced march from Harper's Ferry to Sharpsburg and arrived at the nick of time at the right place at the right time and turned the tide of battle. The thing that you find remarkable when you read about the light division is, first off, most of us have made a 17-mile forced march on the diets that these men have been subsisting on and the condition most of them were. We would not be enthusiastic about charging in the battle. These men went in and cleaned house, pretty much. They had a lot of stragglers, but the men that were left fought hard and turned the tide of the battle and saved Lee's army in the most disastrous defeat. So they had all these battles to their credit. They were a famous unit. The fame comes at a cost. And the cost is unbelievable. This one division, the light division, we're only going to talk about four brigades that would consist of, would make up the light division in Gettysburg, because two of them would be taken from the division. It suffered 8,914 battle casualties by the time they arrived at Gettysburg. 8,914 casualties. That's one division of these armies. That's more casualties by over 2,000 than we lost in the year. So that gives us something longer to measure these guys. The record that the light division won was one of the things that helped elevate the Harold Porter. So he's going to get promoted by the time after the Battle of Chancellorsville to command the 3rd Army Corps, this newly created corps in the Army of Northern Virginia. So Hill rises to Corcoran, and that leaves an opening in the light division. And Hill wants to take command of the light division is Brigadier General Joseph Henry. Clyde, you can hit that first slide. Some of these slides are going to kind of bleed over here a little bit. We can hit, turn down some of the lights a little bit. Maybe the others of these slides. Was you here? Just these? How's that? Now, I don't want to turn down too much. I know you're going to start going to sleep. So, you hear that fan on the fan back on the slide projector, and the lights are on, and the next thing you know, not enough. He was one of the coolest, most self-possessed, and one of the most absolutely fearless men I've ever known, is what one man said. Joseph Pender was 29 years old in Gettysburg, born and raised in the fertile farm country near the Tar River, Edgecombe County, North Carolina, which is in the northeastern part of the state. At age 16, he won an appointment to West Point, graduated in class of 1854. He was number 19 in the class of 46. He and a couple of his classmates, James E.B. Stewart, Jeb Stewart, Samuel T. Shepard, after graduation, the graduates of West Point would get furloughed before they had to report to their regiments in the field. And he and Shepard and Stewart went to Shepard's home, Wood Spring, North Carolina, for a little vacation. While they were there, Pender caught the eye, or she caught his eye, of Mary Frances Shepard. Now, Mary Frances Shepard was Shepard's sister. She was only 14 years old. But 5 years later, Pender never forgot it and came back, and he married her. So at age 19, Fanny was a soldier's wife. By this time, Dorset was an experienced soldier with the 1st Dragoons on the frontier. So off she went for a new adventure, which for many of these wives was not the most pleasant experience. But the one thing I find with Pender, there's a wonderful set of letters that he wrote to his wife. It was published by William T. Hassel. It's called General to His Lady. If you read those, they're great letters, because you find out who this man was underneath the tough veneer that he exhibited to the men around him. He was a sovereign to his wife. He loved his wife very dearly. But he made it clear to his wife where everything stood. After a fight with Indians in June of 1860, he wrote to Fanny, "Darling, do not trouble yourself about the Indians. Fighting is supposed to be my profession, and my wife must be used to me." In 1861, when the South started to secede, there was not any question of this man, Dearest Fanny. He knew exactly what he wanted to do and what he needed to do. He wrote to Fanny in March 1861, "I shall never regret the signing, whatever may turn up." Later, he wrote, "I feel now as I felt then, that I could not serve in the United States Army." He was appointed a colonel of the 6th North Carolina Infantry. He had to bandy about a little bit, trying to pull in some political favors to get some rank. And he takes command of the 6th North Carolina and immediately earned a reputation amongst his volunteers as a very stern and unforgiving disciplinarian. Things that he had learned as a regular army officer, where discipline might save your life on the frontier fighting against the Indians. "I think everyone has confidence in me," he wrote his wife. And the men rather feared him, okay? "I sometimes hear the men question an order, but when it is told it is the colonel's directly, they say no more." So he's got some fear. He developed the 6th into a crack regiment. In the Battle of Seven Pines, his regiment got cut off. And with cool, professional demeanor, Dorsey Pender extricated his regiment from the trap and got them out. Well, by a stroke of just great fortune, it just so happened that the president United States of America watched the entire thing, Jefferson Davis. As Pender came riding out with his men, Davis rode up to him, extended his hand, and he greeted him, "General Pender, I salute you." Of course, Pender was a colonel at that point, so he did it. So he'd been promoted to Brigadier General, which was an extremely rare thing. I don't know anybody else that Jefferson Davis promoted to one command. Most Pender to one command. Pender's going to be given command of the North Carolina Brigade, the 18th Hills Division. From this point on, Pender's star is starting to ascend. From the 7 days' battles to Chancellorsville, he's going to be wounded 3 times, but he never leaves the battle. He stays on the battlefield until the battle is over before he goes to seek any medical attention. So, the war for Fanny, and you can pick this up from what he's writing for her, was incredibly hard, because here this man, he didn't know fear, and the thick of the battle, he was always getting shot. So she would always live with fear that the next battle might be the last. Well, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, Lee was reorganizing his army, and he had promoted a control command, the 3rd Army Corps. Hill wrote an endorsement for Pender, who received command of the Light Division. This is what he said. "Pender had the best drill and discipline brigade in the division, and more than all, possesses the unbounded confidence of the division." We agreed on May 30, 1863, Dorsey Pender now is a major general in the Confederate Army. One of the men who served in his old brigade described Pender, said he was a medium-sized man, 5 feet 10 inches, round of body, close to the hip and muscular. His movements were agile and strong. His complexion was thin. His eye gray and kindly. His whole exterior indicated courage, nerve, and power of endurance. The surgeon of the division observed that the new division commander was brave as a lion, seemed to love danger. He may have, but he was never reckless that I found in the battlefield. The key thing with Pender is courage was very, very important. If you worked for Pender too, you better be a courageous soldier. You better know what you were doing. You better be a professional. Had nothing to do with it. But his reputation for harsh discipline didn't always sit that well with a common soldier. One soldier earlier in the war, who was in a neighboring brigade, wrote that his brigade had a, quote, perfect horror of Dorsey Pender and the fact that they might ever fall under his command. But of course, they did eventually. He gave an example of his brand of discipline to his wife, Fanny, during the Maryland campaign. He was complaining that his men had become a filthy, unprincipled set of villains. He wrote that, "I have had to strike many a one with my savior." So we get some idea how Dorsey Pender dished out his discipline. To Fanny, Pender exuded confidence, and the army started to move in June 63. "May we meet again in my constant prayer. I do not think we shall have much severe fighting this time. We will get more than 4 weeks. We shall have to come back by September or October, for their force will be increasing, while ours will be decreasing. But by that time, we shall probably give them such a taste of war that they may be willing to say quit." I think that Pender wrote here was meant to calm the fears of his wife. Here he was again, marching off, this time going up into Yankee territory. He says, we shall not have much severe fighting this summer. I think that knew it was going to be severe fighting, that the war was not going to be, the victory was not going to come so easily. There were four brigades now, after the Battle of Chancellorsville, composed of our division. These two veteran brigades, Colonel John Rockenbrowse and Brigadier General James Archer, were transferred to the newly created division, named after McKee. And the senior brigadier fighting in the next one is going to be this fellow, James H. Lane. But the division overall had about 7,000 infantrymen and had a battalion of artillery that was organic to the division. Lane's the senior brigadier, and he had five North Carolina regiments. This brigade, since the 7 days' battles, had the highest number of casualties in the division. It lost 2,892 men. Including in that number were their losses at Chancellorsville, which were unbelievable. 909 men in the Battle of Chancellorsville. They also had a little melancholy distinction for Chancellorsville in that the 18th North Carolina had accidentally mortally wounded Stonewall Jackson. Even despite these incredible losses, Lane's brigade was pretty strong when it marched to Gettysburg. There were 1,800 officers and men. And that was probably largely due to the fact that North Carolina did a pretty good job in gathering up conscripts and forwarding to the combat units in the field. The Confederacy had passed the Conscription Act in April of 1862. They stopped creating new units like the Union Army was doing. And they sent draftees directly into the combat units. And that's how they could raise the strength of these units after big battles like Chancellorsville. It's also why almost all Confederate brigades were sworn with the Union brigades in the Battle of Gettysburg, because Confederate regiments were generally bigger than Union regiments by the time of Gettysburg. Lane was 29 years old, same age as Dorsey Kendrick. He was a very popular officer with his men, and he was a man who Pender had a great deal of confidence in. He was very well educated, too. He graduated from VMI in 54. He was graduated from the University of Virginia in 57. Taught at VMI, taught at Florida State Seminary, and North Carolina Military Institute. He took command of the brigade following the Battle of Sharpsburg. The brigade commander, General Branch, was killed. The men and officers from this brigade came from pretty much all over North Carolina, from the coastal region of Wilmington to mountain boys of such places as Gaston and Cleveland counties. And there were two very unique companies in this brigade. They were both in the 18th North Carolina. Company A was known as the German Volunteers. They were the only company in the state of North Carolina that had a foreign distinction. They were Germans. Company F was known as the Scotch Boys. This, I love this company. They had an average company height on muster of 6 feet, 1 3/8 inches. And 60 men who ranged from 6 foot 6 to 6 foot 4 inches in height.
Oh, jeez.
That's the Imperial Guard. Of all the engagements this brigade was in, Chancellorsville was the worst. Lieutenant Octavius Wiggins, the 37th North Carolina, recalled, "I do not hesitate to say it's the bloodiest battle that I have ever experienced." People don't forget combat like this, even though Chancellorsville was a victory. And a number in the 37th North Carolina, Wiggins' regiment, I think, thought it was brutal enough that they weren't going to do it anymore. They were punching out. And on May 19th of 1863, 32 men from Company A, remember, that's the German volunteers, right? Excuse me, this is 37th North Carolina. 32 men from Company A, taking all their equipment, weapons, everything deserved, took off. North Carolina had a problem throughout the entire war with desertions from North Carolina regiments. And the reason was the Supreme Court Justice of North Carolina refused to recognize the Confederate Conscription Act of 1862. So, if you deserted or if you tried to avoid conscription, he would not support prosecution within the state. So many soldiers tried to go back into North Carolina. There was a lot of problems in Western North Carolina, Confederate conscription officers getting into combat, sometimes with deserters who formed into organized bands to resist being conscripted or being drawn back into the army. So obviously these men all their equipment, weapons, and everything like that, passed themselves off probably as some sort of detachment. As far as I know, they got back to North Carolina. It also gives us some idea of why Dorsey Pender, being in the North Carolina Brigade, inflicted such harsh discipline on his men, which was he knew that many of these North Carolinians, if they had the opportunity, once the gun got over the top, were going to scoot out of there. The 37th North Carolina might have had another reason. He had 34 men killed and 193 wounded in the Battle of Chancellorsville. That may be why those fellows beat feet back to North Carolina. This brigade lost 12 of 13 field officers in the Battle of Chancellorsville. Fortunately, a number of those field officers recovered enough from the wounds that they were able to join the army in an invasion of Pennsylvania. The next officer in seniority, just a lousy slide, it's like a ghost, is the ghost of Pender's division, Brigadier General Edward L. Thomas. In some ways, this is appropriate because he's kind of a ghost. Who knows anything about Thomas? Not many people. Who knows anything about his brigade? Not many people. His brigade is one of the enigmas of this division. It's an all-Georgia brigade. We have 1,400 officers in it. From what I can find, this fellow here, Thomas, is a pretty good soldier. He's 38 years old. He's the oldest brigade commander in the division. He was from Georgia, educated at Emory College. He'd enlisted in a cavalry regiment during the Mexican War, the volunteer unit. He captured the son of the ex-emperor of Mexico during the Battle of Cumarata. So that was his distinction in the war. Following the war, they must have thought highly of him because they offered him a commission in the Regular Army to turn it down. He wanted to go back to civilian life. Beginning of the war, he recruited the 35th Georgia Infantry and ascended eventually to command of this Georgia Brigade. His record, from what I can find, is that he always did his duty. His brigade always did his duty. But every time he's look at this unit. They're always the unit that gets left to guard the artillery, to guard the wagon trains, to guard this, to guard that. They're never standing in the victory. Is it the luck of the draw, or is there something else at work for this brigade? I couldn't find anything. I do know that at the Battle of Chancellorsville, where all the other brigades lost the right hand of 177 casualties, which is comparatively pretty low. They had lost, since the 7 days battles, about 1,200 men. That's 800 less than any other unit in this division. So it seemed far less fighting, but the same thing was going to hold true for the Battle of Gettysburg. You can make the next one. The 3rd Brigade, man, I don't have a picture of them. There's pictures of it, but I don't have them. I can show you. This was Alfred M. Scales, the colonel of the 13th North Carolina. Scales was one of those fellows who get wounded in the Battle of Gettysburg. And he'd gone home to recover. In his absence, Colonel W.J. Hope, of the 38th North Carolina, who was the senior surviving colonel in the brigade, assumed command once Pender became the division commander. The thought of Hope commanding this brigade didn't sit too well with Pender. He wrote to his wife that Hope was the greatest old granny. He did not want this fellow leading the brigade in combat. So he must have corresponded with Scales and said, Scales, please come back if there's any way that you can. Because Scales did. Wounded, he left his home, he made his way back to the army and rejoined it, probably somewhere in Maryland or in the Shenandoah Valley. So he rejoined it just probably a week or two before the Battle of Gettysburg. Scales' brigade is interesting because the whole brigade was recruited in the western part of North Carolina. If you know anything about North Carolina during the Civil War, that part of the state did not support secession at all. But this was Pender's brigade, advancing to 7 days' battles, and Pender's stamp of professionalism and discipline was upon it. It lost 2,093 officers in 7 days' army. So these guys had some combat and did their duty. An officer from another North Carolina regiment who visited Pender's brigade in the winter of 1862, he was very impressed by the camp of the brigade, which could tell you something about the outfit. He wrote the camp in a pendant. This camp was a model of cleanliness, regularity, and good orders. The sentinels and guards saluted in strict military style. All officers wore the badge of the rank. I was particularly impressed with this, as it was not by far universal in the army of Northern Virginia. But even though this brigade always had done its duty on the battlefield, this brigade also suffered from desertion affliction In April of 1863, Pender would write our North Carolina soldiers who deserted very rapidly. I have had about 30 in the last 20 days. In a letter to Army headquarters on April 23rd, Pender proclaimed that at least 200 men had deserted from the 24th North Carolina in 30 days. Despite these numerous desertions and his drain on scale strength, he had about 1,500 men in the brigade of the National Pennsylvania. The last brigade was McGowan's South Carolinians. Some of these men were some of the oldest regiments in the Confederate Army, 1st South Carolina, 1st South Carolina Rifles, and the 12th, 13th, and 14th South Carolina. 1st South Carolina Infantry was one of the oldest regiments in the Confederate Army. They were a crack outfit in every respect. If you've ever read any books about the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse, this brigade's one of the units that holds the bloody handle. What they do down there almost defies belief. They were the unit that held the railroad embankment in the Second Manassas. If you've ever read about the Battle of Second Manassas, there was one instance where the Confederates ran out of ammunition and started picking up rocks and throwing them at the Confederates. It only lasted a few seconds. It was this brigade. These men were fighters. Second Manassas cost them 722 killed and wounded, no prisoners. They had already lost 929 casualties in 7 days' battles. Four men were missing out of that number. This gives us some idea of the nature of this unit. McGowan was wounded badly at the Battle of Chancellorsville, and the officer who should have taken command, Colonel Hamilton, had very poor health, so he had to turn command over to the next senior colonel, Colonel of the 14th South Carolina, who was Abner Heron. Abner Heron, 36 years old, Edgefield District of South Carolina. He was an attorney before the war. But during the Mexican War, he had somehow managed to get a commission in the 12th United States Infantry, of which Maxie Gregg, who would be the original commander of this brigade in the early part of the war, was a major. He saw service in a number of engagements in the Mexican War. After the war, he returned to Lake Thomas and went back to civilian pursuits. And then when the war began, he was commissioned a captain of the 14th South Carolina, and he rapidly rose in rank. One officer in the 1st South Carolina described him as an officer of remarkable gallantry, as remarkable discipline, and perhaps more distinguished for these qualities by his devotion to and concentration on military life. Heron had the least combat experience as a brigade commander of all four brigade commanders, but as we'll find, Heron was one of those rare birds who, in moments of crisis, everybody is losing their heads, that's when he thinks the clearest, and that's when he performs his best. And that's the trademark of Abner Heron. Why it's officers like Heron who are people who lead Army to success. To get some idea of the tenacity of this unit, if we compare their losses, 2,670 men, with Lane's brigade, Lane had more losses than Heron's. But Lane had 373 missing and captured, his numbers. Heron's brigade had 13 missing and captured. Out of 2,600, I don't know that you're going to find another unit in Lee's army that is like that. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. Well, following the Battle of Chancellorsville, the Light Division took an opportunity to rest and reorganize. This was this period from May 7th to June 9th. Was something that almost all the soldiers in the division remembered very fondly. Rest and fine weather made up a great measure for our losses, wrote the lieutenant. Another said it seemed a positive luxury to live, just to be alive after you've gone through Chancellorsville. And the spring was unfolding, and it was just wonderful. So just kind of recuperate. This is how I think sometimes the Civil War soldiers were able to get over some of the things that they had encountered. Another man remembered this period as a little bright eye to see his way. But Pender wanted the men to get ready, so there was daily drills and different types of things to instill discipline. And this lieutenant said the drills were sluggishly done. The men held the attitude that the time for the pride and pomp of circumstance was past, and only hard, dry fighters of any kind were veterans now. And plus, the other thing Pender made them do that they really didn't like was he made them drill with knapsacks on.
They always have this picture of the Confederates being a bunch of ragamuffins. They had knapsacks. They had full uniforms. These guys were very well equipped for this point. They didn't like their knapsacks. So Pender made a drill with knapsacks. So that bothered him a good deal. Another thing Pender did during this time period that was going to set a trend throughout all of Lee's army eventually. It had already begun before the Battle of Sharpsburg, and Pender was just adopting something we've already seen, was to form sharpshooter battalions. And now he formed two. He formed one at the Perrin's Brigade, and he formed one at the Thomas's Brigade. The sharpshooter battalion consisted of approximately 120 picked men, formed in three companies. They were generally commanded by a captain. The men selected were young, active, and good shots. When we think of a sharpshooter battalion, we think of a bunch of guys running around with telescopic weapons. This is not what a sharpshooter battalion is to defend an army. These men might do sharpshooting, they might do skirmishing. They're trained to do all different types of fighting, but they're your best shots. They're very active, and some of your best soldiers are going to do your sharpshooter battalion. They do all the skirmishing in the brigade. So generally, a brigade doesn't have to defend. Skirmishing is the voice of your sharpshooter battalion. As the war goes on, the Confederates are going to adopt this practice. Most of the games you'll find in 1864 sharpshooter battalions. They don't use skirmishers over 300 men in the U.S. So in early June of 63, the Army of Northern Virginia commenced its invasion of the North. I do not suppose any army ever marched into an enemy's country with greater confidence in its ability to conquer, with more reasonable ground than confidence in the Army of General Lee. Dorsey Pender, and family. Pender's division took up a line of march to defeat Pennsylvania on June 15th. We're the last division of the Army to leave the Army's camps around Fredericksburg, Virginia. And unfortunately for them, as soon as they started the march, this heat wave was centered upon Virginia. And the march was a nightmare. A member of the 22nd North Carolina recalled on the first day of the march, so many men straggled in his regiment one day, and all of those who did not straggle were able to find shade under a single apple tree. Marcus M. Willis, 13th South Carolina, was among those who could not keep up. He wrote his father that for two nights of the march, it rained nearly the entire night, but everyone was so exhausted that they simply lay down and slept, too tired to care about the water running under us and raining on us. By June 20th, Willis simply couldn't keep up anymore. He found shelter with his family in Rappahannock County. He wrote his father, "Our generals are very hard at marching, harder than Jackson." Now, there's a statement that tells you how hard that march was for these fellows. What's happening here is these men have been in camp basically for a month, and a lot of them went soft. And when they hit the road again and started marching, these marches were tough. And these early marches winnowed out. The guys weren't going to be able to keep up. So as the marches, as each day progressed, the men grew stronger, healthier, and less straggling. The less men getting sick. So soldiers like Marcus M. Willis was probably better off if those men fell out of the ranks than they were during the march. Once they crossed the Potomac, entered Maryland, and headed towards Pennsylvania, boy, things started to get pretty good. This is the best country I believe I ever saw when the soldiers and parents brigade. On June 21st, Pender wrote to Fanning, "Everything thus far has worked admirably." A surgeon of the 13th South Carolina, right home with his wife, "I've never seen our army so healthy and in such gay spirits. How can they be gay?" That attitude pervaded this army. This is one of the most competent organizations I have ever read about. All the letters that they wrote at the time period. Some of the men, feeling of revenge was coming from them. Coming out here to Pennsylvania. It's a fertile land. The Yankee Army has not always treated Virginia and southern states with kid gloves. And these men, many of the men in the division, are thinking, now's going to be our chance for retribution. It's one of the reasons that Lee publishes that general order that forbids any type of unauthorized foraging. But as Pender writes, it will be hard to restrain them. They have an idea that they are to indulge in unlicensed plundering. For a brief period, it appears that they did. J.J. Willis, 13th South Carolina, wrote, "Our army treats citizens tremendous bad. It is scandalous going to their dwelling houses, taking private property, watches, money, milk, butter, chickens, anything they can put their hands on." Later in that letter, Willis noted that 200 to 300 soldiers of the division were under arrest for an unauthorized forager. So it appears that Dorsey Pender didn't stand for it for very long. Clamped down on it, posted guards at people's houses, and the fellows who defied the rules were arrested. However, authorized foraging went on with abandon. We're taking everything we need, horses, cattle, sheep, flour, groceries, and goods of all kinds, and making as clean a sweep as possible, wrote Dr. Welch of the 13th South Carolina. Pender, before the invasion, had been looking forward in a way to making the Yankees feel the hard end of the war. Now we see the soft side of Pender. Once he gets into Pennsylvania, he sees the fear in the eyes of these civilians. They're very afraid of the Confederate Army because they don't know what the Confederates are going to do. He says, although the Yankees have made us suffer, all the people have suffered, I cannot get my resentment to that point to make me feel indifferent to what you see here. So he doesn't take any pleasure in what he has to do. There's people who are probably very upset at seeing their possessions taken away, or cattle, or sheep, and things like that. What Pender sees disturbs him and bothers him. As for arresting the men, the surgeon of the 13th South Carolina, the soldiers must have a strict and severe rein held over them. If not, they're worthless. Although the bonds of discipline might have slipped a little bit in Pender's division for a few days, Pender couldn't tighten things up. But overall, this division was ready for combat. Lieutenant J.F.J. Caldwell explained, we were veterans, thoroughly experienced in all that relates to the march of battle, sufficiently drilled to perform any maneuver at all might be demanded, sufficiently disciplined to obey orders promptly with energy, that preserving enough of the proud individuality of Southern men to feel the cause of our own, therefore to be willing to encounter the greatest amount of personal danger and moral responsibility. Let's see that sentence again, because it's very important to understand this language. Sufficiently disciplined to obey orders promptly with energy, yet preserving enough of the proud individuality of Southern men to feel the cause of our own, therefore to be willing to encounter the greatest amount of personal danger and moral responsibility. Caldwell also added that it was properly equipped than at any period prior or subsequent to this point. Everyone had confidence in the valor of their comrades and the skill of their officers. The victories of 1862 and the Great Battle of Chancellorsville this year have led us to believe scarcely anything impossible could return. The management of our generals, which had wrung even from the North the highest praise, gave us assurance that every particle of our strength and courage would be most judiciously and powerfully applied. Another very important thing, they trust their leaders, which we will both then. As Caldwell would write, by June of 63, they believed Robert E. Lee, invincible, the division rested for a couple of days around Fayetteville, Pennsylvania, where they were gathering supplies. And on June 30th, Pender received his orders to march in the direction of Gettysburg, because that was the direction that the Confederate Army was going to move. Lee was planning, after receiving word of the approach of the Union Army on June 28th, in the last days of June, Lee was starting to move his army to the eastern side of the mountains to threaten Gettysburg, hopefully to draw the Army of the Potomac into the battle with him. As Pender's men started out with the marching on today, it is Route 30, the National Road, or the National Highway. And the road was macadamized, unlike a lot of the roads in Virginia. It started to rain. In Virginia, the road turned to rough and muck. But with these macadamized roads, it was great marching. The men found the rain to be very refreshing. And in fact, they enjoyed marching in the rain. So they marched up South Mountain, through the South Mountain Pass, and they bivouacked on June 30th, where I think is probably the Buchanan Valley, from the description that the soldiers gave. They thought it was a gorgeous setting. And the war for many of these men just seemed so distant, so far away. It had to seem unreal in the range, too. If you were about this beautiful mountain setting, you had to see a man and a soldier in weeks. And the war just seemed distant, seemed far away. It seemed like you could almost sense what it meant once again in that case. But it would last only a few hours. Because on that same day, as we know, Henry Heath's division, the foraging expedition to Gettysburg, found Gettysburg occupied by the cavalry, he's turned around and marched back and reported to the county Gettysburg. So the next day, General Hill ordered Heath to march to Gettysburg and find out what was there. He orders Pender to ready his division to follow Heath to march to Gettysburg. These veteran soldiers of Pender's division, in orders to cook rations, and the early march hour, they were supposed to march at 5 a.m., aroused suspicions. Men believed we were about to meet the enemy. It was about 4 a.m. on July 1st, sergeants started to rouse the men up, form them into their platoons and companies. We rolled up our blankets and flies in haste, we called the lieutenant of the division. Hated knapsacks, the men had conveniently found ways to get rid of them and march up to Pennsylvania, so they were probably littering roadsides here and there. The men were wearing more comfortable blanket bags by this point. The sharpshooters of Perrin's brigade would lead the way, and the rest of the division would follow. And they started off the morning of July 1st, 1863. It was a cool, humid morning with showers passing over. They marched about 2 or 3 miles in the direction of Gettysburg, the Chambersburg Pike, when suddenly they could hear the distant sound of artillery. The enemy were in front. Dr. Welch, the surgeon of the 13th South Carolina, peered into the faces of the men. As he heard this artillery fire, looked at the men as they were marching past. And he said, in the countenance of all, an expression of intense seriousness, solemnity, which I have always perceived in the faces of men who are about to face death, the awful shock of battle. So you can see in the eyes of these men, they know what's coming. They're beginning to gird themselves inwardly to prepare for doing their duty. At about 10 o'clock in the morning, Pender's division crossed Marsh Creek. Once they reached Boyd's Schoolhouse Road, I've out in Keller's water, where I always take my car, that's Boyd's Schoolhouse Road, and that's that road north and south of the Chambersburg Pike is where Pender forms his division in the Round Valley. He posts two brigades north of the road, he posts two brigades south of the road. Thomas and Lane's brigades form north of the road, and Scales and Perrin's brigade form south of the road. From that position, if you stand out there even to this day, there's a little housing development just south of the first shot mark. There's a private road that goes back in. If you drive that, you can see the view. Not just all the houses and everything that Pender's men would have. And they could see, one man said, Heath's cannons in the distance, firing away at the Yankees. We could also see the infantry of Heath's division advancing along the valley. Now, Dr. Welch thought it was a magnificent sight. He wrote his wife, it was gorgeous. He could see this wide panorama of soldiers down there. He could see everything. It was so open, so clear. I imagine a veteran infantryman looking across that, thinking, there's no cover out there. It doesn't look that good to them. This is tough country to fight in. This is good country to lose again. So soon after he had formed his division, probably took a little while for his division to form. I imagine it was at least 11 o'clock. Pender ordered his men forward. They're going to move across the open space between where Boyd's Schoolhouse Road is and Hare Ridge. As the men moved across that ground, they moved in line of battle. They moved in line of battle. You had to move any distance. Officers generally moved in column. It was a much easier formation to move around. You moved in line of battle, you got disordered by everything under the sun. There's constant faults and reforming the line, and then sometimes if your company ran into some outbuildings and had to break concrete around, you had to run to catch up to everybody. Well, as Lieutenant Caldwell recalled, the perspiration poured from our bodies. Even though it was kind of a cool morning, it was very keen. These guys are sweating. As they're moving up towards Hare Ridge. Still hear the artillery fire going on. Eventually, they're going to arrive on Hare Ridge. Wait a second, before you turn, that's the Hare Tavern that you see out there. That's Hare Ridge. You're looking at it from McPherson's Ridge. And along Hare Ridge, north, this is about 1880s, this photograph. North and south of the road, along that ridge, are going to be two battalions of Confederate artillery, Hebron and McIntosh. They're shelling the Union troops. Heath's division, most of it, is off to our left in the woods along Hare Ridge, which today is part of the park. So Pender's men are going to come up and form behind Hare Ridge, most of it, in support of this artillery. Now, immediately behind the Hare Tavern is where Scales' brigade was They never formed in front of the artillery for some reason. They don't really explain why. But as one man said, it gave them the best view of infantry fighting I ever saw, where they were fighting. This is taken from actually what they call Schoolhouse, which Hare Ridge is right in front of me. But you can see how the ground sends the artillery, some of the artillery is on this ridge, the photograph's taken from. And in that time period, without some of the trees down here, you can see, particularly as you move farther south on this ridge, you get a very clear view of Pearson's Ridge. So Scales' men are laying down, probably in this low ground right behind the cavern. There's also artillery over here on the left. Lane's brigade initially would have been right down here. Thomas's brigade farther over. And Scales here, and Perrin farther up in that direction. Very soon after they got into position, the sharpshooter battalion up on Perrin's right reported that there was cavalry over in that direction. He also reported that there was Union infantry approaching. Union infantry is Colonel Chapman Biddle's brigade, which marched up a long Willoughby run and turned off the Fairfield Road so he could challenge the main body of the First Corps. Because these guys don't know what's going on, so they're like, hey, there's infantry, there's cavalry off on the right flank. So Pender orders Lane's brigade to leave that position and march south along the front of the division of the south. So now we have Scales, Perrin, and Lane deployed south of the Chambersburg Road. Thomas, another view that you can see on Thomas's position, we're going to defense. This is the ridge. First photograph you saw was taken from up here looking this way. This is looking south along the ridge of the Confederate artillery being in position. Let's have the next one. One of the volunteers at the park took these photographs for me. And when he started, it was like gloomy and rainy and everything. The picture was real dark. And it's like a bright sun as he came back up. Got some great shots. This is shot from the McPherson point. Eventually, on the afternoon of the 1st, Pender's division was ordered to advance to positions up near the McPherson point. Because East Division was fighting, they were to move up in close support. East Division is going to fight for all this ground. Pearson Barn, off to the south a little ways, this farm of Herbst, Woods, and Fleming for the next month. This gives us another idea of the type of the open ground that these men are going to see in front of them that the Pender's men are going to have to attack. Next. This is what it looked like in 1863. Herbst Woods over here, Pearson Barn would be in this direction. See the woods for the Lutheran Seminary back here. This is the Seminary Woods. This is McPherson's Ridge right here. It's about 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon of July 1st. Heath's division renewed the attack against Herbst Woods, the McPherson Barn, McPherson's Ridge. And for nearly an hour, they were engaged in terrific fighting for the first time. At 3 p.m., Pender received his orders to advance the direct support of Heath's division. So he ordered Scales, Perrin, and Lane to move forward. Thomas stayed back to guard the artillery. As Pender's men advanced slowly, they went over Hare Ridge, crossed Willoughby Run. As they crossed Willoughby Run, they started to encounter streams of wounded and stragglers coming back from fighting in front. Some of Pettigrew's men, clearly shocked by the carnage that brigade was suffering, warned Perrin soldiers, saying we would all be killed if we went forward. Thomas Littlejohn, 13th South Carolina, wrote, we did not hold for the stragglers, but opened ranks for them to pass to the rear. So you might imagine that some of these soldiers, the way you encounter this, these veterans, is with some contempt. These are new troops. They didn't know what they were doing. That's why they're resting. And you explain it well. They're not like us. We know how to fight. We'll be better. As one soldier said, when they came upon the ground fought over by two of Pettigrew's regiments, the field was thick with wounded hurrying to the rear. The ground was gray and dead and disabled. Like most of the soldiers, they had been content to stand and fire instead of charging, which he believed they accounted for their heavy losses. South Carolinians were about to discover that the enemy in front of front was pretty darn stubborn. Accounted for many of the casualties. The Pettigrew was making suffering. By 3:30 p.m., Heath's soldiers were fought out. As I mentioned earlier, they lost 2,000 men. They had appalling losses, were low on ammunition. And now it was time for Pender's division to administer the coup de grace to the disorganized, defeated, or at least believed disorganized and defeated Yankee soldiers in the First Corps. It appeared to these men of Pender's division that they were. We could see the Yankees running in wild disorder with Captain Shooter of the 1st South Carolina. General Scales observed Stone's Pennsylvanians leaving the air supply in great confusion to the rear. Finally, at about 4 p.m., A.P. Hill came up and gave Dorsey Pender his orders. These were what they were. Past General Meade's division, if found at a halt, and charge the enemy's position. Pretty simple. Ask General Heath, he's at a halt, and charge him. There's nothing fancy or deft about Hill's tactics. They are relying upon the land and the courage of Pender's men and one of them, their blood, to do the job. These were commodities that these men had shown everybody. They possessed them in abundance. So Scales men are going to move right into this little low ground. Scales Brigade is formed along this low ground on up into Farmer Herb's woods. Perrin's brigade is south of the woods. Lane's brigade received its orders to move forward a little bit late, and its movements were delayed by Buford's cavalry. Buford and one of his regiments maneuvering very aggressively against the right flank of Lane's brigade. And some of you may have heard the story that some of Lane's regiments formed square to resist a cavalry charge. I looked very carefully to find any evidence of that. I found no evidence whatsoever. I did find, however, the cavalry caused Lane a great deal of problems, and Lane was very slow in moving forward. So Perrin's brigade has nothing supporting it on the right front. The thing that's interesting here is that neither Pender nor any of his brigade commanders had any idea at all of the enemy's strength or of his position. Imagine you're here, and you're told to go charge. What are you going to do? You're in the middle of the battle. You don't have a lot of options here at this point. You don't know anything about what's going on. It seems incredible today that something like this would happen. But it wasn't unusual in either army during the year, where attacks were frequently ordered with only the vaguest information or notion of where the enemy were or how strong they were. Pender and his brigadiers, I think, probably believed that a very swift charge would clear the last line of resistance, because these men have already shaken their fight with Heath's division and Rhodes' division off to the north. With rapidity of movement being essential so that the enemy did not have time to rally and reorganize, the advance was going to be made on the artillery support. So they're not going to waste any time to bring artillery up and soften its position up a little bit. They think the Yankees are on the run. The faster you move after them, the better off you are, and the less men you lose. That is a truism. It might seem like craziness to go charging over that hill, but that's what experience has taught these men. You move quick, you pursue quickly, you lose less people. They're about to find, however, that the men in their front were neither defeated nor ready to give up the field. Defiant, they were ready to fight. You had elements of three brigades, Stone, Meredith, and Biddle, swung out along Seminary Ridge. Within the Seminary Woods, and up here, in the middle of the woods, we'll see some pictures of the modern day with Robinson. Earlier in the day, Robinson's division had constructed a wooden barricade. The barricade wasn't at the front of the woods, it was in the woods. These woods were very open. The barricade was concealed. You couldn't see it until you got close to the woods. Falling in behind the barricade, and then Meredith and Biddle's brigades. There's a lot of artillery support also along this ridge line. Arrayed to the right and left of this infantry were four batteries of artillery. Captain James Stewart's battery B4th US. Those men were on either side of what today we call the infamous hill over the top, east of what they call the bloody hill over the top, near General Lee's restaurant, or whatever they call it now, Larson's Hotel. On either side of the railroad company there were three Napoleons of battery B4th US. They're very important. South of the Chambersburg Pike, was the 5th Maine Battery, Battery B, 1st Pennsylvania Light Artillery. And farther south along the ridge were 4 3-inch rifles of Battery L of the 1st New York Artillery. They were down along the intersection of the Fairfield Road of the present-day Seminary Avenue. So all told, there's about 18 guns along Seminary Ridge preparing to defend that position. South of the position of the infantry, and south of the Fairfield Road, is a little woodlot that is called today Schultz Woods. In that woodlot were 3 regiments of cavalry, of Gamble's Brigade. Now, we often imagine that Buford's men did their hardest fighting in the morning against Heath. That's not true. Their most effective fighting is about to come. These regiments, the 8th New York, 3rd Indiana, and 12th Illinois, they're going to dismount and move up to the front edge of Schultz Woods, looking out towards the YWCA and the present-day Chrysler dealership. While speed was definitely essential for Hill and for Pender to pursue what was believed to be the beaten foe, I think A.P. Hill's tactics with Pender's division are unimaginative, expensive, and I think somewhat surprising in light of the experience of the Battle of Chancellorsville. That battle, the veteran infantry in this division, had charged Union soldiers in entrenched positions. It was bad enough that after Lane's brigade had been massacred in one effort, Ramseur's brigade, Rhodes' division, came up to pass through them. And Lane came up to Ramseur, completed it. He said, "Don't go out there, you'll be slaughtered." Ramseur said, "Get out of my way." Went forward, and exactly what Lane predicted would happen. So here we are, going to do the same thing. We're going to go right at it, straight on. The interesting thing is if Hill had shifted the weight of Pender's attack even 1/4 mile south, they would have outflanked the entire first corps line, rendered all that Union artillery null and void, and nearly cut off almost the entire first corps. The only thing to stop them would have been 3 regiments of Gamble's cavalry. What was at Hill's fingertips, I think, was a spectacular victory, won at very small cost in loss of life, wounds, and other misery inflicted upon these excellent soldiers who ran under his command. That's not the type of soldier that A.P. Hill was. He went right at him, and that's what he's going to do. So after he received his orders from Pender, Colonel Perrin moves his brigade forward. He soon came upon Pettigrew's brigade, which was lying down, and they're so exhausted that it scarcely even raised a cheer to Perrin's men. After he cleared the line, Perrin halted his men and summoned all of his regimental commanders. And one of his regimental commanders recalled the orders that Perrin gave. General Perrin gave orders to the field and staff, and he communicated to the rank and file that they were to move forward without firing, that they were not to stop under any circumstances, but to close in, press the enemy close, routing from its position. We might think about this. You don't know these guys are fired. They're just going to charge over the hill and not fire. What Perrin understands, and what any veteran soldier knows, is that as soon as your soldiers stop and start to deal with fire, it gets very hard to get them going. And if they stop in the open, and the enemy is covered, they're going to lose. So the duty of the line officers, the lieutenants and the captains, is to make sure their men do not stop and fire. Keep moving. You're going to lose people, but if you move steadily forward at a steady gait and get close to the enemy, the odds are you'll lose less people than if you stood in the open and started firing, or if you stood in the open and started firing and then tried to run away and get back to cover. Once you cross into the danger zone, the safest thing you can do is close to the enemy as quickly as you possibly can. That is what experience has taught these men to do. On Perrin's left, Scales had nearly 1,500 officers and men. They rise up from this ground right here, and now they're going to go forward. Lane is not in sight. Perrin's kind of looking around nervously because his right flank has no protection. So orders are orders, and they'll move out. Scales' brigade command attention was heard all along the line when it rose up. Every man rose to his feet, grasped his arms with a firm grip. And the order, forward guide, left march, moved off at a quick step across the hall. The line sweeps over west of Pearson's Ridge, and the bodies of hundreds of dead and wounded Federal soldiers and some scattered Confederates there. And then they're going to move over the ridge down to the open ground, cutting through the next line. That's what they're looking for right there. That's some of the deadliest ground there's about. That's deadlier ground than the Confederate soldiers faced in this charge. You compare that ground to what they're faced in this charge. The nature of it is very gradual ascent. It is the best killing ground a defender could ever ask for. So these guys have no idea of terrain and topography of any strength that is charged right over the hill. And this is what they see. The Union gunners had loaded up their guns with either canister or shrapnel. And they let them have it. As soon as they come up and over the crest of McPherson's Ridge, from where this photograph was taken, the captain of the 2nd Wisconsin recalled it seemed at almost the same moment as if every lantern was pulled by the same hand. This line of artillery opened at Seminary Ridge blazed with a solid sheet of flame. And the missiles of death had swept its western slopes, no human beings could endure. Scales Brigade drew the attention of nearly all the guns posted north of the Seminary buildings. Particularly, this is the position, up here is the position of Battery B, 4th U.S. They're going to fire shrapnel and canister at an oblique angle at Scales' men as they cross. Scales' left is going to be about on the Chambersburg Road. So Scales' men are moving down here, they're taking this fire from here, from all this artillery that goes. Every discharge made sad loss in the line, but one man in the day. Yet nevertheless, Rufus Dawes and 6th Wisconsin wrote that Scales regiments maintained their alignments with great precision. Spiking shells exploded and tearing through the ranks, knocking people apart. Scales has no support on his left flank. No one was advancing there. So Stuart swung 3 of his guns around so they could fire down, almost down Scales' line, with double charges of canister. It's murderous. Confederates keep coming. So the Yankees start dumping down double loads of canister. They're pouring in the infantry now, they're delivering infantry fire. Get some idea of what these men are going through. 13th North Carolina. There's 180 officers and men that they could be attacked. They lose 150 men. 83% of the men go down in this charge. By the time the brigade reached the low ground between the two ridges, they're going to get all the way down to here. Pitzer's Run. By the time they get down to that point, they couldn't stand anymore. Places that were within 100 yards of the Confederates, the Union artillery musketry was just tearing to pieces. And Scales reported our line had been broken up, now only a swath here and there marked the place the regiments had rested. Every field officer except one was shot. Scales was shot again, and the chances were a piece of shell in him to save it. Many companies lost all their officers. They were the leaders. They were the guys who were supposed to tell the guys, come on, keep going. They're gone. Soldiers were either laying low in the dirt, or some, many of them, who become panic-stricken, went back over McPherson's Ridge. Charging Confederates were brave men, you know, Yankee. In fact, no braver ever faced death in any cause. None ever faced more certain death. The 1,400 officers men present in this brigade, 545 men would become casualties, probably in a matter of 10 or 15 minutes. Scales attack down towards the Seminary Ridge line has been stopped full. Now we got Perrin's brigade. That's the next unit. Over to the right, let's find out what's happening again. 5 people. This is just still giving us more of a view. This is some of the artillery positions to the left of the Seminary that would have been firing down on Scales, and some were firing on Perrin's men. Now we're looking at ground Perrin's men, of course. We're going to come right down over this ground. This was a fence line in 1863. There were no trees here. This was all open ground, except for the woodlot right up here in front of the cemetery. There's still a little bit of the woodlot left. So now, Perrin's men are charging over the ridge. They charge over the ridge at almost the same time. Scales, maybe slightly behind Scales, but pretty close. And as they look out there, they see, look at that ground. Man, that's a great view. It gives you an idea of what these guys were looking at. They were veterans. They knew what the rear teams were announced. This is going to be tough. We were met by a furious storm of musketry and shells from the enemy's batteries to the left of the road from Gettysburg, reported to the parent. But the brigade continued to advance until they reached a rail fence. Rail fence, this one right here. Brigade moves all the way down, reach that fence, at that point, that's where the Yankees and the barricade were waiting for them. That was when they were within range, and they could score a lot of hits. And at this point, the guys in the barricade poured in. Herring reports it was the most destructive fire of musketry I have ever been exposed to. Coming from a guy who came from the brigade, he said, as much fighting as this kind of thing, now we understand what they're thinking. There's the bullets, tons of them coming at them. Company K of the 14th South Carolina has 34 men shot with 39 men. So you can only imagine what it's like in these units at this point. They're sickening thuds as bullets are striking bodies. Some soldiers are screaming and yelling out. Men are writhing in the ground with wounds with blood pumping out of them. Other men are yelling and hollering. Officers are shouting and cursing at their men, trying to keep their men in some type of order. When I try to give people an idea of what a Civil War battle is like, the best barometer most people have for the event of a battle, which most of us hope we never will be, is movies. And people always point to the movie Gettysburg. I think the movie Gettysburg is a pretty good movie. I always tell visitors to the comments, if you want to know what the battle was like with these men in the Civil War, go see the movie Saving Private Ryan. It's about World War II. But that is what these men went through. It was bloody carnage, it was intense violence, and you still had to do your duty. You still had to keep your head, you still had to be able to think, you had to try and maneuver soldiers under this type of fire. In the first volley of canister, shrapnel, and mini balls, nearly half of the 14th South Carolina was going to go down. They lose almost 200 men on July 1st. If you hit the next slide. That's another view showing the ground currently. This is the wood lot. We extend up in this area. The barricade is probably in the vicinity of the parking lot. That's about where the rail barricade is. This is Seminary Ridge. That's the Lutheran Seminary. Seminary Woods. Chambersburg Pike. Scales Brigade is advanced and they stop here at Pitzer's Run. Herring's Brigade is advancing against the Seminary Woods here. 14th South Carolina is being chewed up by the fire from the Federals and barricade. Most of the Federals are in this area. Now remember, Herring's got nobody to protect his right flank. Pretty soon, Buford's men started firing away with their carbines. So he orders the 12th to the 13th South Carolina to peel off and attack those men, delivering the flank fire and driving them away. The 1st South Carolina hits a fence that doesn't show up on there and gets very confused because they're under fire too, and then they hit this fence and it drives the man, one of the soldiers in the 1st Air, into a solid mass. So it's just a big bunch of guys, no military organization at this point. So the situation is becoming pretty perilous at this point. The 14th South Carolina reported Herring, it looked to us as though this regiment was entirely destroyed. There's so many men that were shot down, there's smoke all around, there's a lot of confusion. So it looks like things are pretty bad then. And then the 12th and the 13th are moving off over towards Buford's men. 1st South Carolina is a big mob of men. But Herring comes through in the crisis. He goes to the commander of the 1st South Carolina, Major C.W. McCreary. He orders him to take this mob of men and oblique his men to the right. You've got to move your men to the right. What he wants them to do is get around this barricade. Get around the flank of the barricade. It's the only chance you've got. And then, Herring is going to ride over to the 14th South Carolina and ride through their disordered ranks on horseback, flashing his sword, shouting to his men to keep moving. One of the men said, filled with admiration for such courage as defied the whole fire of the enemy that they had followed, for the shout was itself half a victory. So you can imagine these men just were screaming at this point at the top of their lungs, just everything they got in them. There's a fire of battles on them now. They see their leader, and he's not being hit. Less than a year later, he's going to try the same thing. Scott's going to kill us. And this time, I'm going to die. not a mistake. Leads the 14, they start to move forward. First South Carolina is moving in a mob, but they're moving nonetheless. The thing that's going to give Karen's men a little break is there's four guns of Reynolds' battery here, and then there's Buford's cavalry. But between the guns and the barricade, there's no remaining. So the 12th and 13th move in this direction. The 12th is going to be able to get up and flank Buford's cavalry position. The artillerymen go to the supports, they see that they're firing a canister with rifle guns, they're not going to stop the Confederates. So they deliver up and they pull out. And the 12th and 13th are going to be able to outflank Buford and drive Buford's men to the field. But, as we're going to find, not without very, very heavy cost, 12th South Carolina lost 26 dead, 105 wounded. 13th South Carolina had 35 dead, the highest in the brigade, 105 wounded. Most of those losses, from what I can determine, all occurred fighting Buford's cavalry. So this is where Buford's men do their hardest fight, is over ground today visiting the National Park. So now we're left with the 1st and the 14th South Carolina. This is where it's come down to. Two regiments trying to break the first corps hold on Seminary Ridge. The 14th shot to pieces, basically, and the 1st South Carolina is in this mob. Yet nevertheless, watching this charge of the Confederates, Colonel Charles Wainwright, man in the 1st Corps Artillery Division, who wrote this journal that evening, "Never have I seen such a charge. Not a man seemed to fold it. Lee may well be proud of his infantry. I wish ours was equal to it." Give me the next slide. This is the great killer of scalesmen in some of the 14th South Carolina, the artillery. This is looking from Perrin's position off towards where scalesmen are laying on the ground. Remember, a lot of those men are up and over the crest of the ridge. And Perrin's men are probably also taking some artillery fire at this point from Stewart's guns up near Larson's Hotel. This is looking from the direction of the barricade towards the position that Perrin's men are attacking towards. This would be the 14th South Carolina, right actually, over this ground. This is where the rail barricade would be. This is the remnants of the Seminary Woods right here. Some of the hardest fighting of the first day's battle is going to occur right this area. Another one of them, under the area of the barricade, looking up towards the Seminary Woods. This is right behind the YWCA. And it is also on the flank, probably the approximate area, the flank of the rail barricade. Somehow, the 1st South Carolina able to swing around and get on the flank of the, they're able to get on the flank of the defenders of the rail barricade. There's so much confusion and so much noise at this point that the men of the 1st South Carolina are able to fire several volleys into the defenders of the barricade before they realize that there's enemy soldiers on the flank and getting on the rear. And this turns the tide of battle. So the 1st South Carolina is a crowd of men mobbing up around today where the YWCA would be, getting onto the flank of the defenders of the barricade, firing down their flank while the 14th South Carolina was firing at the front. And these soldiers of the barricade have been fighting all day, they're exhausted, and they see reds to the rear of the sun again. And all of a sudden, resistance starts to collapse, and these guys start screaming back over Seminary Ridge, leaving Wainwright's artillery without any infantry supports. So everybody now is starting to take off and run away. So the 1st South Carolina has tipped the battle in balance in favor of the Confederates, and now they're starting to press home and attack. You see these batteries along the ridge. The battery men are starting to limber up their guns as quick as they can to get them off the ridge. Wainwright would write, "I had little hopes of getting them all off, but the Rebs were close upon us. So near that a big fellow planted the colors of his regiment in a pile of rails within 50 yards of the muzzles of Cooper's guns at the moment he received his order to limber up." This was undoubtedly the color guard of the 14th South Carolina. It was not part of the original color guard because they were all dead. And they were all killed. This is where the person who picked up the colors and still happened to be alive. To stave off the advance of the 14th and 1st South Carolina, Admiral Doubleday would take Company D, his headquarters guard, 149th Pennsylvania, post them near the Senate buildings. He said they held off the Confederates for a full 20 minutes. It may have seemed like 20 minutes to defenders, but I think it was probably closer to what Perrin reported. It was the work of 2 minutes to dislodge these men. They fought all the leaders in 2 minutes. And that gave the children time enough to limber their forces up and start to retreat. This is another view of the ground where the 1st South Carolina, probably the ground where they would have gone on the flank of the other areas. We got one more chance. This is a post-battle shot of the seminary building. And Wainwright recalled as his batteries started to pull on from Chambersburg Pike and try to escape, the infantry were all marching along the road trying to get away, the 1st Corps infantry. So he did not want to order his batteries to gallop because he was afraid of the panic at home. And then he turns and you can see, coming around the south side of the building, the 1st South Carolina infantry, his big model guys, while shooting at this man in the hand of the infantry. Road. Moments later, the 14th South Carolina comes around both sides of the seminary buildings. The men closed upon the guns with all the rapidity their exhausted limbs would permit for the Lieutenant Caldwell of the 1st South Carolina. The range of 50 yards, the men opened fire upon the artillery in Chambersburg Pike. The impact of this artillery, this infantry fire, was all the infantrymen in the road ran off the road. If you look at the next slide. The infantrymen all leave the road and run over into the railroad embankment to get protection from fire. And at this point, Wainwright orders his batteries to move at a gallop. They're going to start galloping down the road, the Chambersburg Road, looking towards Seminary Ridge. And the 14th South Carolina, the 1st South Carolina, are running across these fields. That's your position, trying to catch up to the shooting at you as you're trying to get away with your vehicles. Despite the best efforts, the bullets of the South Carolinians, every one of those guns got away except the gun. This belonged to Battery L, 1st New York Light Artillery. And as they were pulling down to the next slide, probably near this spot where this photograph was taken, they shot one of the horses on the limber, and that stopped the limber as it was going to keep horses, because it was going to be off the limber. And as the artillerymen tried to cut the horse out of its traces, they shot more horses and they started shooting at the men, and the men decided that they couldn't save the men and ran away. And some of the 1st or the 14th South Carolina foot race were the first men to use this gun. It's the only gun captured on the first day by soldiers of A.P. Hillsport. So it was the first 3-inch ordnance rifle ever accepted by the Ordnance Department in New York. That's just kind of a curious sight. Men of the 1st and 14th South Carolina went shot, collapsed with exhaustion, straggled, pressed on along the Chambersburg Pike in the direction of the town of Gettysburg. All was in confusion for the men. In fact, there weren't an awful lot of men left. One soldier in the 1st South Carolina thought there were only about 50 men left. The 14th South Carolina was probably the same amount. Their line extended from the present day railroad line, the railroad embankment. We're over here in the photograph, over to the Chambersburg Pike. This they started to advance towards the town. There were lots of Yankees running around, as you can see. A lot of them were hiding in buildings and houses and outbuildings and so on. So Perrin ordered a detail of men to go start picking these men up. They captured so many men that they had to start forming extra details to get these soldiers, back to the rear. They advanced as far as Washington Street. That was where the advance halted. Because at that point, Hender thought they were advancing way too far. In fact, Hender thought these two regiments may have been captured. He came galloping after them, caught up with Perrin on Washington Street. He rode up to the front of the 1st South Carolina after he ordered the two regiments to fall. He took off his hat and saluted the colors. And he recalled one of the men of the regiment. He said, "Our regiment had done enough for one day. He ordered us to the rear, the rest, and get water." It's probably one of the men from one of these two regiments who shoots Chaplain Howe on the streets of on the steps of the Lutheran Church in town. Chaplain Howe's death starts to come from a better perspective when we realize what these men just went through. And they find that an officer, at that point in the battle, you weren't differentiated as to whether it was a chaplain or who was their sword. It was an officer. He asked him to surrender his sword, and he didn't do it. He shot him. that point in the battle, we don't know what that commander went through and why he shot Chapman out. But I suspect it was probably a command from one of these two regiments who tripled on head of the men in Washington Street. So these regiments are going to pull back towards Seminary Ridge, and their part of the battle is essentially over. In fact, the part of the battle of Pender's division is essentially over. Pender and Scales, even though Scales is very badly wounded, take great exertion. There's some interesting words that are used to describe how they rallied Scales' brigade. It's obvious that Scales' brigade was really demoralized. It took a great deal of effort to get these men back into some sort of organized line that was capable of any type of effective service. Pender's division had lost approximately 1,100 killed and wounded, no prisoners. This was a charge to take the ridge. 1,100 killed and wounded. They had taken Seminary Ridge, they had done their job, they forced the First Corps to retreat to Seminary Ridge. The land and courage that appeared and prevailed again on the day of the Army Corps of Virginia. Among the frontline soldiers, there was a sense that they hadn't won a complete victory. They captured many prisoners. They'd only taken one gun and a caisson. Other than that, all the First Corps artillery got away. The enemy returned to another range of hills behind Gettysburg with the captured shooter. I've never been able to see why they were not pressed still farther, as they had plenty of daylight and some fresh troops. Admiral Parent, right immediately after the battle, was disgusted. The very batteries which we had run off, which we saw them take off from Gettysburg, were the first to fire a shot from any position. The first shell fired by them from that position was aimed at my brigade. Surely, Scalesman took very little solace in making it. Colonel William L.J. Lawrence, who took command of the brigade while Scales recovered from his wound on July 1st, found it depressed, dilapidated, almost unorganized. On July 3rd, they could only take 500 men in action. Here was charge. The heavy casualties in these two brigades also tempered the victory. The nature of the ground was such, and the contest so brief, that the wounded could not be moved. They were wounded twice, thrice, and as many as four times after first being stricken down. They called the commander of the 14th South Carolina. The ground that they had advanced over was a killing ground, as we've seen. It was a perfect killing ground. Not a foot of ground presented a place of safety for the current ground. The ambulance corps stood helpless during the action, unable to evacuate the wounded because of the murderous fire that swept the field. Men never fell faster at this brigade, perhaps never equally so, except in Moore's regiment. The survivors of Scales Brigade laid out for the view for that assessment. I think without detracting anything from the courage of these South Carolinians and North Carolinians who stormed that ridge on July 1st, their triumph owed much to luck. There was very little artillery on Perrin's front, and there was a gap in the First Corps defensive line, well barricaded down to the Fairfield Road. And First Corps defenders were disorganized. They were exhausted before they were attacked. Generalship had very little to do with their victory, but much to do with their appalling casualty list. A.P. Hill, a repeated attack that has undergone success in other fields, go right out, straight out, despite the losses. Maneuver was not a consideration in this attack by A.P. Hill. So Pender's men went right into the very teeth of the enemy's defenses and suffered the consequences. Victory had been achieved. But I think the most spectacular and most expensive victory was entirely possible for Pender to have achieved that day. It only shifted the weight of the attack from the front to the south. It's doubtful that Lee noted these smudges in his victory on July 1st. The most spectacular victory. The example of Chancellorsville had been repeated. The land encouraged and conquered the advantages of the enemy's position, just as they had done at the Battle of Chancellorsville. 2 days later, the Battle of Gettysburg reached an impasse. Lee sought to duplicate the success of Perrin's men on July 1st on a more massive scale, by smashing the center of the Union Army and Cemetery Ridge with a huge attack by 11 brigades. This time, as we know the story, the land and courage were not enough. The result was slaughter and defeat. The victory had seemed to an odd twist of circumstances, but ultimately led to the defeat of the Army.
There's some early accounts and scholarship, Hassler, even Gettysburg Magazine, flip-flops the 12th and 13th and the 1st and 14th, as the 12th and 13th on the left of the line and the 1st and 14th. How do you...
Well, all the evidence that I found is the 14th, the 1st, the 12th, and the 13th. And it
makes sense.
Yeah. And then there was one other regiment that was the 1st South Carolina Rifles was actually guarding the Rifles regiment of the division, so they weren't there on the first day.
When was Bender wounded?
He was wounded on the second day, shortly before his division was supposed to advance. After Anderson's division had advanced, he was riding down to look, take a better, closer look at the ground, determine how where he would move his men. And I think a shell fragment ricocheted off a rock or something like that, and cut an artery in his leg. And they were able to stem the flow of blood, and then they evacuated the battlefield during his transportation back to Virginia. His leg hemorrhaged and died. I heard that Fanny, when she learned that Pender was dead, locked herself in a room for a week. Take no food, right now, room which we can move. And the impression you get was the grief that she suffered. This was unbelievable. And she would never speak of his death at all. Just couldn't let her.
What effect did Wayne have after he was moved to the far right?
Yeah, that was a good question because I forgot to wrap up. He did eventually advance, and I think one of the things with Lane is the appearance of the terrain is so open. Lane's experience at Chancellorsville was so rural, and I think he was a little bit cautious about moving across this ground with cavalry moving around his flank. So eventually, he started moving towards his direction of his advance was towards the McMillan House. And there was some scout cavalry that skirmished with him a little bit, but as far as I know, he didn't lose any men, other than maybe two or three guys on the first day. And they advanced up the Seminary Ridge around the McMillan House and then halted there. So they probably encouraged Buford's men, who were fighting with the 12th and 13th South Carolina, to leave because they saw this particular native soldier. But other than that, they really didn't do too much.
What were his specific orders once he was moved to the right?
His orders probably were the same as parents. They were just they were straightforward and engaged the enemy. And the enemy ran away from him, so he didn't have to leave. Another question. Any others? The only thing they really did in the battle was they ended up in Long Lane, or the Southern Lane, just south of town, and they skirmished on the second and third day of the battle, which were only for all the casualties. The first day is the early brother division.
How has Pender's division been conducted on the battlefield or Has it been for rotten times this year and rejuvenation in terms of popularity?
That's a good question. What they did on the first day is not very well known, principally because that area of the battlefield is not taken. Because it didn't fall into the Western Front property, the Seminary property. So, and plus, it was where the Confederates drove the Yankees back at that point in the battle. So, in the early years, when the Gettysburg Battlefield and the Foil Association fought, man, that wasn't the primary agenda. As the War Department became involved, I think the War Department probably understood that there wasn't going to be a great deal of change there. But as you'll note, you drive Seminary Avenue, which is a park avenue. There's some Union artillery position there, but there's very few tablets at the southern end of the avenue. There's nothing to tell you that this unbelievable battle took place right there in front. So it's that part of the battle is not very well known and not interpreted very much. Maybe I would imagine some of the license balls for the guides have told you because we would be asking them. But unless we do special for the programs, the part we don't interpret it very there's not much there. The seminary, I believe, is interested in doing some interpretation about that. But it's a part of the battle that helps you understand, too, these tactics in the third hand.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the 12th and 13th South Carolina because they hit the wall that's by Schultz's Woods, I think, is where they hit Gamble yeah. Strokes. What kind of happened?
The
13th would
have hit it head on. And the 12th swung up and got around its front. And from what I can gather, they washed the coffee out of that cavalry. Because the cavalry, with a big sort of target, put out a lot of bullets. And it was beautiful to me. And what caused the cavalry to get ground was the 12th down the flank. And they could see Lanesman. Knew they couldn't stop all of them. So the 12th and the 13th probably halted around the area that you're looking for. That's probably where they could stop. One more question? All right, thanks a lot.